Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So, what are we going to talk about today? Well, science marches on, and I've been doing science education on the radio for about 28 years in one form or another. As I read the first of the articles I'm going to share today, I found myself wondering how much else of what I learned in school is just plain wrong. How much of what I tell you will turn out to be a dead end or a misinterpretation? We've certainly seen our share of wrong interpretations of ambiguous data over the last few years. We've seen people stonewall and double down on their beliefs. There are many ways to ignore data, what one former presidential candidate called an inconvenient truth. But enough about that existential crisis. Let's talk about one that's a little more recent and a little more immediate. And that's the issue around how we handled the early stages of the COVID-19 epidemic. Today's show is all about the power of small things, literally small things to start, but also small decisions, subatomic particles, and also small minds. So we start with a 60-year-old scientific mistake, one that has been, enshrined in all of the medical textbooks you're likely to find on any shelf in any library anywhere. And just like a friend of mine in the Firesign Theater used to say, everything you know is wrong. Well, hopefully not everything, but certainly the devil is in the details, as I like to say. So all epidemic long, scientists have brawled over how the virus spreads. It's been droplets, no, aerosols. And at the heart of the fight was this error. I'm going to take you back to a PhD aerosol scientist at Virginia Tech named Lindsay Marr. And this is about April 3rd, 2020. Things are just getting rolling with the COVID epidemic in Europe and the United States. New York and New Orleans are in serious trouble. And she's an aerosol scientist, as I said, and one of the very few in the world who actually also studies infectious diseases. You'd think that would be a fairly obvious thing, but it turns out that, well, those two branches of science are siloed, and they don't talk much to each other. Well, Marr thought that the coronavirus looked as if it could hang in the air, infecting anybody who breathed enough of it. But just about the time that she was saying that, what the World Health Organization was saying was, well, no. They had actually tweeted, fact, COVID-19 is not airborne. And that's why these people, 35 aerosol scientists, met on Zoom that morning, is because they were talking about this and trying to decide if they believed it and if they didn't believe it, what they were going to do about it. And they went through the list of super spreading events in restaurants, call centers, cruise ships, choir rehearsal. We had the data from the restaurant in China. We had the cruise ships docked and with growing numbers of people getting sick, even though they were confined to their cabins. We had the choir rehearsal, where people got sick even when they were 20 feet away from the index case. What's going on here? Well, it was winter in the north. Well, that's enough to keep the windows closed. That all contradicted the main safety guidance, which was 3 to 5 feet of distance between people and frequent hand washing. So if COVID was only in large droplets, then wouldn't that have prevented those super spreader outbreaks? Had it been a doorknob that managed to do all that damage? Well, to them, it looked more like infectious air. But World Health Organization wasn't going to budge. They wanted proof. So they got into a fight. There was one very, very well-respected atmospheric physicist who was the one, in fact, who coordinated the meeting. Her name is Lydia Morawska. And one of the experts just cut her off, said, "You're wrong." Yeah, you don't argue with the physicists about physics. And Morawska had more than two decades advising a different branch of the World Health Organization on air pollution. And when it came down to flecks of soot and ash that came out of smokestacks and tailpipes, well, the organization readily accepted the physics that she was describing there, that particles of many sizes can hang aloft, travel far, and be inhaled all the way down into the smallest parts of the lung. But this branch of the World Health Organization, a very large, I might add, organization, was saying, well, because these are infectious particles, you know, that doesn't apply to them. Airborne applies only to particles smaller than 5 microns. And so they were just, well, trapped in a language barrier. I can think about several examples of that I've seen in the last few years, where people just don't hear each other and they don't define their terms. Now, lots of these women scientists had been ignored by members of the medical establishment. They'd been sort of passed over. This was a global pandemic. This was not about ego. And so Lindsay Marr started on kind of a crusade back there in April of 2020 to try and get the world to pay attention to the fact that this was a respiratory illness, that we needed to ventilate surfaces, that we needed to wear masks. Now, measles and tuberculosis both transmit in very different ways, but they're both described as airborne. They travel inside aerosols, which are tiny little particles that can stay suspended, just like cat dander, in the air for hours and hours. And when you breathe, you suck them down into the smallest parts of your lung. If you go to the books, they say, well, the air is the enemy. It's 5 microns. The difference between droplets and aerosols is 5 microns. So any infectious particle smaller than 5 microns is an aerosol, and therefore it's going to hang in the air for a long time. Anything bigger is a droplet. And it took these scientists quite a long time of going through ancient literature. And I want to share that story with you, because the facts were staring everyone in the face by April. Respiratory bugs require close contact, but in a small space, a lot can happen. There are a lot of mechanisms, and you can't tell from the epidemiology what the mechanisms are. So Marr decided to collect some data. This started in 2009, because she already thought this was a problem. And so she installed air samplers in places like daycare centers and airplanes, places where flu virus spreads. You know, according to the textbooks, flu virus was on droplets and shouldn't be in the air. But she found a lot of it, and she found a lot of it up in the air where it was obviously around for hours. And she couldn't get it published. This is 2011. She finally gets it published in the Journal of the Royal Society Interface. This is a niche publisher, not seen. Nobody read it. She was out there on the fringes with her good idea. And when you go to the libraries, like I said, the medical textbooks simply say 5 microns. That's the threshold between aerosols and droplets. There was a researcher in Hong Kong back in the first SARS epidemic in 2003. His name is Lee. Let's see. L-I. What's his first name? Yuago Lee. There it is. Like to credit people if I can. So he did research in the Amoy Gardens apartment complex that showed that the coronavirus could be airborne, spread through the apartment complex. So he decided to work out the math, and he did beautiful simulations showing that when a person coughed or sneezed, the particles were too few and the targets were too small. So he concluded that the public health establishment back then had it wrong. But you couldn't find where this came from. Where did we get this 5-micron thing? It took a lot of scholarship and a lot of research, and they couldn't still find it. They tried citation tracking, which is where who said what, who cited whom, doesn't work. So she finally did like a broad Google search in the CDC's archives, and she plugged in 5 microns in tuberculosis, and bingo, she found it. This was a paper published in 1955, and it was called Airborne Contagion and Air Hygiene. Starting back in 1934, two researchers analyzed air samples and looked at gravity and evaporation, and they found that Particles bigger than 100 microns sank to the floor within seconds, but anything smaller than 100 microns could stay in the air. I want to remind you, this is 1934. The paper was published in the 50s. There was a 400-page book that nobody ever read, and what stayed in the textbooks was this 5 micron. Later on, this man did some really elegant research using ultraviolet lamps. These were air-disinfecting ultraviolet lights. He put them in the schools in the 1940s. And in the classrooms that had the lamps, almost no kids came down with measles. So measles virus must be airborne, right? Good evidence. He also looked at working in the mines, and he found that the mucus of the nose and throats are just really good at filtering out particles bigger than 5 microns. Anything smaller than that? Well, that's how you get black lung disease. There was also a study looking at tuberculosis. Tuberculosis, when it's aerosolized and gets deep into the lungs, it sort of grows like a tumor. If you get a mist, either fine or coarse, bigger or smaller than microns, he could infect rabbits with tuberculosis. And he also showed that if he filtered air from a tuberculosis ward and filtered it with a 5-micron filter, none of the guinea pigs did get sick. So the data was contradictory, and the 5-micron data won the arm wrestling contest, even though there was other data that suggested otherwise. And that's become enshrined. I remember being taught that in medical school. We care about aerosols, and most diseases are droplets, and it's all about 5 microns, and bigger than 5 microns, it falls to the floor. Except that was absolutely, completely wrong. And here we are now dealing with that issue. So let's listen to Sybil from SoCal. Dear Dr. Don, a radio talk show host doctor wrote a book, It's All in the Head. That's the name of the book, meaning that most illnesses stem from osteoporosis in the skull. Is there any truth to this? I didn't know there was such a thing as osteoporosis of the skull. Furthermore, he maintains that gluten is the evildoer of just about any ailment known, including it being the cause of the easy and severe COVID infections. He makes his case with India, comparing southern and northern India, where people either mostly ate rice or mostly wheat. He explained how people who mostly ate rice had a much lower infection rate than those who ate wheat. Personally, I don't eat gluten or extremely little. I would still like to know how bad gluten really is. Is it the source of all diseases? I need to mention that same doctor is also selling extremely high-priced supplements that he suggests everyone should take. For your information, that doctor's name is Dr. Joel Wallach, and he used to be a veterinarian, and he's now a functional medicine doctor. Dr. Wallach. Dr. Wallach and I go way, way back, Sybil. He's got a few other books. I remember one very provocative title from the 90s, Dead Doctors Don't Lie. The problem with Dr. Wallach, in my opinion, is that he's not always wrong. And he spins data and plays a lot of rhetorical games. Now, that's fine if you're going for entertainment. But if you're trying to have a rational scientific discussion, it's cheating. You know, when you run a massive million-dollar multi-level marketing program, you're probably cheating. Just because, why would people pay top dollar unless they were getting a sales pitch? I don't really believe in that. So let's start with the fact, and full disclosure, that he and I have philosophical differences. Now, that's not surprising. I had to put my hand up and swear to something called the Hippocratic Oath. Don't think they have to do that in veterinary school. Maybe 15 years ago, Dr. Wallach tried to recruit me to his multi-level marketing thing, and we had an interesting lunch. And during that time, he told me a lot of autobiographical information, which I won't share with you today, except to say that events happened in his life that made him feel disrespected, and he decided to show people. And he has. He's showed him, all right. Now let's go to the substance of your question. Osteoporosis of the skull. there is a condition called Paget's disease, which is a type of problem with the formation of bone in the skull. Paget's disease of the bone affects the skull, and that's where it's usually first diagnosed. And instead of having that nice white basketball of a skull, kind of a bicycle helmet, really, when you think about the cranium, instead of having that nice thick white cranium, what you've got is a kind of a Swiss cheese pattern to the skull. And this is a disease that can be treated. You'll also see that Swiss cheese pattern with certain kinds of cancer, multiple myeloma, for example. But the more important thing about this disease is it's not really osteoporosis. Osteoporosis, as I would define it, it means thinning of the bone, but it also means subjecting you to a risk of pathological fractures. And you just don't see that with osteoporosis of the skull, which you can see in people who are severely malnourished and maybe people who have undiagnosed celiac disease and get very, very thin and very, very nutritionally deficient, because their gut literally loses the ability to absorb nutrition. So getting to the osteoporosis skull, I don't think it's a thing. It's certainly not the cause of a lot of other diseases. I have never seen data, and I would challenge anyone to show me some. Just like there's probably nothing that cures all diseases, there's probably nothing that causes all diseases. Although I will comment that inflammation is at the root of most disease processes. Inflammation is more of a mechanism rather than a cause. Lots of things cause that inflammation. So wheat versus rice. Well, it's true that if you eat gluten, you're certainly more at risk for a leaky gut. Even if you don't have the DNA to develop celiac disease, you can develop non-celiac enteropathy, and this will include loss of the integrity of the membranes that protect the inside of the intestines from the inside of you, because technically You're a very, very elaborate donut, and what's inside your stomach, small and large intestine, and rectum is outside of your body, separated from your bloodstream, separated from your circulatory systems, although connected via a couple of thin membrane layers such that you are able to absorb. Just like you don't mix your blood directly with the oxygen in the air, you run it past the air sacs through very thin capillaries. The air is on the other side of a very thin wall called an alveoli, and that's how you exchange gas. Well, you exchange nutrients and vitamins and all kinds of things across a similar thin membrane in the gut. And if that membrane loses its integrity, well, sometimes you're going to exchange things you shouldn't. That is the crux of a whole lot of functional medicine. So you see, he's sort of kind of getting into functional medicine there when he talks about wheat and rice. And I want to emphasize, the gut heals really quickly. You could eat wheat every day, although if it's heritage wheat, and in Europe they don't have quite as much of a problem for this, what we've done is we've monocropped our wheat, and we've amplified the toxic component, semi-toxic, let's call it, gluten, to very, very high levels, because it makes things so nice and chewy. Furthermore, we do some other cool things in this country with our food supply, including throwing Roundup on the wheat to stress it so that it increases the crop yield by pumping every last bit of its dying breath into saving its babies, that is to say, making the little wheat grains bigger so that, hey, your wheat crop yield is higher. Well, that sort of finishing the crop is great as long as all the Roundup goes away, but we now know it doesn't all go away. It can contribute to leaky gut, and that's been established in animal models. So the dose is in the poison is an old, old medical saying. It's a medicine until it's an overdose, and then it's toxic. Well, you can be toxic on gluten, and a lot of the population probably is. And if you have that kind of gluten toxicity, you don't get osteoporosis. But if you have celiac disease, you definitely can. And it's only when you stop eating wheat and all gluten, if you have celiac, that your gut gets to heal. And I will say that I have personal experience of at least one case where that documented osteoporosis disappeared gradually over about a decade after the person was diagnosed and went off gluten and was able to recover most of their gut function. This is a lifelong commitment for people who have gluten. It is not a mirage. There are people who have this, and it can make them very sick or even kill them, and it could certainly give them osteoporosis. For the non-celiac gluten sensitivities, that's a spectrum that goes from no problem to fairly uncomfortable, unpleasant, but non-lethal. So, is Dr. Joel Wallach a functional medicine doctor? Well, in my opinion, he's not a doctor. He's a veterinarian by training who's been an executive and a radio talk show and author for most of his career. So he can use the DR if he wants to, but he doesn't take care of humans. So I'm not so sure how well qualified he is to advise them. And he certainly has, shall we say, a conflict of interest when it comes to advising them to use his, and they are indeed, fairly expensive vitamins. And by the way, I've looked at the doses. I've looked at what's in them. It's good stuff. It's just way overpriced. A long answer to a short question. Let's go to an email from Helen from somewhere, writes, "Hi, Dr. Dawn. Your talk on coffee and coffee makers tonight was interesting but confusing to me. I'm not sure which is the most preferred and which is the least preferred ones. Ones that use brown, not bleached filter, like pour-over coffee filter, versus French pressed or ceramic pour-over, which don't use filters." Well, Helen, I'm sorry that I'm going to confuse you further, because it's confusing. It's as simple as that. There's good sides and bad sides to the percolator coffee. And the good side and the bad side are about the same molecule, this chlorogenic acid. And the chlorogenic acid does raise cholesterol, which is not so good. The people who have high cholesterol and are struggling to lower it might consider, rather than going on a statin, switching to a unbleached coffee filter for a month or so and then repeating their levels, because they may inadvertently be kicking their levels up. And I am currently, as a person who has high good cholesterol and high bad cholesterol, doing the experiment of using a filter. I'm going to do that for a month, and then I'm going to get my cholesterol checked, and I'll let you know how much it drops. It maybe will be a lot, or maybe it won't be much. And of course, that's what we call in science an N of one. But when I read this, I thought, yeah, I'm going to do the experiment. There are a lot of other good things in coffee, other compounds which do get absorbed by that filter. And a lot of the data around coffee having anti-cancer effect, coffee having anti-inflammatory effect, and anti-cardiac disease effect. So go figure. Your cholesterol goes up, but your risk of cardiac disease goes down. Well, maybe that's because your risk of cardiac disease is much more about inflammation than it is about cholesterol. By the way, I read an article just recently from Mass General where they stated that the whole idea that heart disease is not about cholesterol is a hallucination of a few highly vocal people on Twitter. Sorry, guys. You're looking like you're on the side of the 5-micron people on this argument as well. It's really as simple as that. If you don't have cholesterol issues, you probably shouldn't use the coffee filter because you're filtering out some of the good stuff. It's kind of like boiling your vegetables instead of steaming them. You're leaving a lot of the nutrients in that water. So unless you use it for your smoothie the following day, and even then, if you steam your vegetables, if there's much color to the water, yeah, save that overnight in the fridge and use it in your smoothie, because a lot of the good stuff we talk about with fruits and vegetables does come out in the wash, so to speak, when you cook your food. Would it be a Ask Dr. Dawn show if we didn't at least once in the program pivot to the gut? Of course not. So nerve cells in the gut detect what we eat and communicate with the brain. The brain, of course, communicates with the gut, telling it to do stuff like, oh, I smell food. I see food. Maybe you should make some saliva. Okay, I'll make some saliva. No, while you're at it, make some gastric acid too, because pretty soon that mouth, which is chewing, yeah, you're going to get a swallow soon. As soon as that swallow hits, we need some acid in the stomach. Okay. And off we go. A dialogue between the gut and the brain. But that nerve runs both ways, and there are efferent and afferent. So efferent means coming from the brain and going out to the fingers or any other body part. Afferent means starting in the periphery and working its way back to the center. So there are two types of neurons in the gut, and they are located in terms of where they set their roots down and get their food and all of that in the same ganglion, but they innervate two different portions of the gut, and they control two different things. One controls satiety, and the other controls blood sugar levels. When we consume food, information about the ingested food is transmitted from the GI tract to the brain. The brain decides whether we should continue to stop eating based on this information. In addition, our blood sugar levels are adapted by the brain, and the vagus nerve goes all the way down, and the nerve cells are mainly situated in something called the nodose ganglion. And some of the cells go to the stomach and some go to the intestine. And as I said, these are two-way streets. A lot of the nerve cells, particularly in the stomach, are stretch receptors, so they're noticing distension. Others detect chemical signals. These are mainly inhabiting the intestine. And what's super interesting is that the ones that are in the stomach, when you activate these nerve cells artificially in mice, presumably using an electrical stimulator, the mice eat substantially less. And they've established that it's activity in the nerve cells, how fast they fire on the way back to the brain, that is key for getting the appetite-inhibiting signals to fire off in the brain. And these cells also decrease blood sugar levels. But the second group of nerve cells primarily innervate the intestine. And this is interesting. You have bitter tasters and you have sweet tasters. These cells have nothing to do with your satiety. They have to do with activation with your blood sugar. And in fact, when you stimulate these cells, you raise the blood sugar. And if you stimulate the ones that sense bitter taste, you actually lower the blood sugar. This is one of the things I heard, gosh, back in high school from one of my classmates whose father was a chiropractor and said, well, don't chew sugarless gum, Dawn, because it's the same as chewing sugared gum. And I'm like, I don't want to get fat. I chew gum all the time. I'm going to chew sugarless gum. Teenage girls, right? But it turns out that if you are diabetic, the so-called sugarless gums probably elevate your blood sugar by fooling the sweet receptors in your intestine. And the activation increases blood glucose, which I find a little paradoxical. But also interesting, activating these sweet receptors does nothing to reduce your appetite. So lots of standard medical recommendations flow from this. Among them, eat a salad before your meal. Don't eat bread, which breaks down to sugar immediately. Go ahead and eat a salad. The salad is going to mean that when you eat the rest of your meal, your stomach is going to be stretched. You're going to not eat as much. You'll have something to take home and have lunch tomorrow, thus saving you money. And furthermore, it'll help you maintain your weight. So eating something bulky to help stretch out your stomach before you eat the main, more calorie-dense course is probably an excellent idea. Also, slowing down the meal is also has been shown, and I'm not quite sure what the mechanism is here, to reduce the overall amount that you eat, which seems a little paradoxical. Obviously, something is happening with satiety in there. But I thought it was very interesting that we don't really think about taste buds in our intestine, but they are in fact there, and they play a fundamental role in regulating blood sugar. Now, while we're on the topic of blood sugar, let's move to small decisions, right? We're doing small things here. Well, small decisions. People who eat a healthy diet, including whole fruits, may be less likely to develop diabetes, but not people who eat juice. This is a typical eat this, not that, but I do want to point out that this study looked at 2 servings of fruit per day or less. but they didn't look at 4 or 5 servings of fruit per day. And I've had, at this point, a lot of patients over the years who were fruitivores. They just ate lots of fruit, you know, a couple of pieces of fruit for breakfast, fruit for snacks, you know, 5 a day, not unusual. And uniformly, they complained that they could not control their weight, that they couldn't lose weight no matter what they did. They weren't consuming that many calories. How come they couldn't lose weight? And one of them, one out of, I think, 6, actually did what I suggested and stopped eating fruit and ate vegetables instead and more protein and was able to lose weight. There's something called the fructose-pentose pathway. I promise, I will not give you a physiological pathway tonight, but it affects satiety and has a fairly profound effect, apparently. So too much fructose will even cause diabetes. Back, you know, speaking of everything we know is wrong, back in the 70s, we were giving diabetics fructose as an artificial sweetener because we thought that would help them. Turns out it actually was a double whammy, raising their blood sugar. Didn't work. Diabetes is a big problem. So it's been studied up one end and down the other. This study was done in Australia. There was a statistical diet recall study. Those always have to be taken with a grain of salt, if you'll pardon an unintentional pun. And the reason you have to doubt diet studies is that people don't remember what they had. Do you remember what you had for dinner last Thursday? Yeah. So this is why diet recall studies have a problem. You get, at best, a kind of rough estimate of what people are actually eating, and a lot of people fib. Sorry to disillusion you if you thought people always told the truth about that. Here's the big advice from this. The study, for whatever its drawbacks are, did show a 36% lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes over the next 5 years compared to those who consumed less than half a serving of fruit per day. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means that the people who ate more fruit ate less of something that was even worse, and they did not see the pattern for juice. So in other words, if you ate enough fruit juice that would be the equivalent of 2 servings of fruit, and they probably messed up on this study and had 2 4-ounce servings of fruit juice, which is actually more like 5 servings of fruit. Don't drink juice, okay? You know, all these juice bars around, I look at the menus at the juice bars and I'll find maybe one juice that does not have apple or beet or carrot. It doesn't have something sweet. If you're going to drink juice, it can be juiced greens, but you can't drink juiced fruit and lose weight, and you can't drink juiced fruit and consider that you're getting the health benefits, because just like we were talking about with the stomach stretching, a lot of the benefit in eating fruit or vegetables, and I'm sitting here looking at Howard eating a large bowl of vegetables, you get the benefit from the fiber. The fiber is the food for your microbiome, the stuff that you leave on the table, so to speak. Well, your microbiome just licks its chops and thrives on the stuff you can't digest. That's why this is a commensal relationship. It's a symbiosis, rather, because they scratch our back and we scratch theirs, so to speak. And one of the things that they do is they modulate our immune system. They help us fight off diseases. They give us vitamins that we're unable to make on our own, like vitamin K. They are enormously beneficial entities, and they protect us from other pathogens. So we need our microbiome, and why would you not want to feed your friends? You know, give them a banquet. Give them a big bowl of veggies every day, or whole fruits, but keep it under 2 a day, because like I said, more than 4, and you're starting to get into danger territory. One more word, if you are diabetic or pre-diabetic, stick to fruits that grow in the northern latitudes or the deep southern latitudes. Stay away from fruit that thrives at the equator. I had a patient yesterday say, "Why can't I lose weight?" We're going to talk about his issues in just a moment in reference to another article. But he said, you know, what? I said, "Well, what'd you have for breakfast?" "Oh, a banana." It's like, okay, no, couple hard-boiled eggs. Much better decision. Some kind of protein in the morning, minimize the starch, and particularly starchy fruit, which has both sugar and starch in it. Or, you know, toast with jam. Not a great move, particularly if you're trying to lose weight or you have blood sugar issues. So our next small thing is small changes. This is a small behavior change. I want to start out with saying that I have a major criticism of this study because it assumes causality when it may just be looking at correlation. That is a common mistake, and particularly now that the scientists have their new genetics toy box, they're like, oh, well, you have this DNA, and we see this, so this must correlate to this. And it's like, maybe. And you need to prove it, and this is just epidemiology, and epidemiology can never prove anything. Let me say that again, because it's really important. Big group science is a blunt instrument. When you ask people what they ate and you compare it with another group and ask them what they ate, you're not going to get great data. Even if you track them and put them in a motel for 2 weeks and film their every movement to see what they eat, that starts to approach a level where you might be able to draw some conclusions. But then you have the lead time problem in that you can only really afford to do that with a small group of people, which may not be representative of everybody. And you can only afford to do it for, you know, a few weeks. So you can't really do good science that way. This is one of those kinds of studies. It was 840,000 people, a lot of people. And it was done looking at a person's sleep propensity. What time do they fall asleep? What time do they wake up? Essentially, it showed that there was a correlation between getting up early and a lower risk of depression. There's been previous observational studies, but the problem is when you have depression, it messes up your sleep. So who's the chicken and who's the egg here? And that's another science issue, is you don't know which one is cause and which one is effect. That's different than the correlation problem, but it's just as difficult to work out. So there was a long-term study of 32,000 nurses showing that the early risers were 27% less likely to develop depression over 4 years. So now, of course, we've got our DNA toolkit. So we get these researchers who turned to data from 23andMe and a biomedical database. And so they looked at genetics, and they found about 340 common genetic variants that seemed to be correlated with sleeping. And they found that genetics could explain from 12 to 42% of our sleeping timing preference. Well, which one is it, guys? But essentially, they used all these data from, you know, as I said, 850,000 individuals and 85,000 wore sleep trackers. And then they had another 250,000 who filled out sleep preferences. And so that gave them some kind of information. And they basically found that there was about a 23 to 27% variation depending on when you went to bed. So the sweet spot here is probably to get up at 6 a.m. and go to bed at about 11 p.m. And if someone's going to bed at 1 a.m. and they go to bed at midnight instead, they drop their risk by 23%. If they go to bed at 11, they dropped it by 40%. Hard to tell whether this is just in people who make the change, what the natural early risers might not get a benefit. But there are some theoretical reasons to think there may be something to this. And this falls into the category of might help, won't hurt. My God, it's summer. It's light by 6 a.m. Maybe greater light exposure during the day results in hormonal inputs that can influence mood. There's plenty of data that suggests that. And the winter blues and seasonal affective disorder add more weight to that. So maybe just getting up earlier so that you get more daylight and using artificial darkness at night or blue blocker glasses if you're going to be playing around with LEDs or CRTs, because you know what? The LEDs and the flat screens put out blue light, which confuses your brain to thinking it's morning, which is bad for your sleep. It suppresses your melatonin. You don't want to do that. Let's move on. This is a study in female soccer players. It was a massive survey, 43,000 males and 39,000 females from schools in Michigan. And what they found was a very big difference in the likelihood that girls would have a head injury. Girls' concussion rates were 1.88 times, almost double the concussion rates of boys. And this was not particularly well understood. It seems like boys' most common way of being concussed is through bashing into another player, with half of their concussions happening this way. Girls were more likely to be concussed after colliding with the ball. In other words, I guess how the ball hits their head hard, or one of the goalposts. And this is something that was really interesting. Because the mechanism of injury is different, coaches don't take girls out of the game. So it appears that boys are often, because of the nature of their injury, pulled off from play and evaluated, whereas girls are often not thought to have sustained an injury that could cause a concussion, probably just because no one really thinks that the ball could cause a concussion. Well, apparently it can. There are physiological, biological differences between males and females. You may have noticed some of them. The more subtle ones relate to muscle strength, muscle volume, bone density, and a whole host of other things that have implications for the health. And as much as I, you know, expect to be treated as an equal, I also recognize that just as men have unique vulnerabilities, I'll point out the prostate, a gland I'm very glad I don't have, women have their own vulnerabilities. Breast cancer comes to mind. As come to think of it, prostate cancer and breast cancer are kind of, I don't know, I guess even the playing field a little bit, so maybe it's compensatory. Let's go to something else small. MicroRNA. Well, that's small RNA. This is something that when they started the Human Genome Project, no one even thought it was a thing. They thought that the genes that coded for proteins were the bomb, and that was where all the information was going to be. And there were all these other genes, these introns, that nobody understood because they obviously were not spelling out amino acids. So we called them junk DNA because we didn't know what to do with them. And I remember that term from my college education. Well, junk DNA turns out, of course, not to be junk, but in fact to be the operating system for the entire ball of wax, so to speak, the entire mechanism of physiological regulation. Yep, it's the OS for everything. This junk DNA codes for microRNA, sometimes called small interfering RNAs. They're subtly different, but for our purposes, microRNAs are a little bit of non-coding DNA that have been transcribed into RNA, but they're not messenger RNA because they're too short and small, and they do something very different. So this study from the University of Eastern Finland, which, by the way, has a terrible cardiovascular disease problem from a country statistic standpoint, and so they do a lot of research on this, has uncovered some really interesting microRNA mechanisms that appear to drive atherogenesis. What's that? Well, atherosclerosis and arteriosclerosis is the progress of the arteries becoming progressively narrower due to the formation of plaque. Atherogenesis is the term for the act of formation of plaque. And these plaques contain cholesterol deposits, calcium, foam cells, which are macrophages, big amoebas that were grabbing bacteria in the bloodstream but have graduated to grabbing cholesterol in the wall of the bloodstream. The progression of this disease is a series of progressive changes in how the DNA is being transcribed and working in this system of smooth muscle. Well, first of all, the lining cells called endothelium, the smooth muscles, and these macrophages or foam cells. The molecular mechanisms that do the controlling turn out to be microRNA quite a bit of the time, and we're beginning to understand those control mechanisms. So the researchers have really been looking at this and looking at what differentiates an area that's going to get an atheroma, that's going to get a plaque. And they found that there are really two types of microRNAs, something called the mature cell type. This is found in all of the cells, and there's maybe 2 to 5 abundant species. But then they found these microRNA messenger networks, which drive specific responses, particularly in maintaining tissue homeostasis, in other words, preventing plaque. When you get this signaling dysregulated, that's why you get plaque. Remember I said I had that patient who asked why did he stay fat, and I asked him what he had for breakfast? The other thing to understand is that once a gene gets turned on, the microRNAs are at play. They're regulating it. They're basically, it's like a railroad switch that's been flipped, and now you're on this other track heading off in the direction of obesity. And it's very hard because the tracks are separating and gaining momentum away from each other. And so you get further and further and further away from a health-maintaining pattern or a health-creating pattern of your DNA replication. It's very hard to turn it off and very easy for it to turn itself back on again because it already has a bias in that direction. Yo-yo dieting is, and I want to emphasize this, yo-yo dieting is the worst thing that you can do if you're fighting to control your weight. Now, yo-yo dieting is different from intermittent fasting. And we're talking about people who go on a very, very nutrient-depleted minimalist diet, like eating nothing but iceberg lettuce and vinegar for weeks at a time. If you're thin, you can get away with this without turning on the gene path. But if you're overweight and you do this, you're likely to actually have it backfire and stimulate these dysregulatory genes and cause the DNA that's going to make you heavier be the DNA that your body gets programmed to run, running the wrong program. I know one woman, I know her socially, she has an internet diet business, and she, at one of our girls' parties a while back, was commenting on how when she wants to lose weight, she goes off to one of these spas and does nothing but wheatgrass and tea for a couple of weeks, and the weight pours off of her, but she always gains it back. And I am convinced it's because she has shifted her DNA multiple times, and she's created a bias in the direction of weight gain on what would be a normal caloric diet. And particularly under COVID, if you're primed that way, the last year has been really difficult for you. So now let's talk about subatomic particles. And this is some research that just came out, just published, looking at the Chernobyl accident, which happened, as you'll remember, in the Ukraine, and it was a nuclear power plant that melted down. There was a large radiation exposure to the local population. We've now got adult children of people who were there. The complete genomes of 130 people born after that, one in 1987 through 2002, and then 105 mother-father pairs, one or both parents being a worker who had helped clean up the site, and they may have also had prolonged radiation exposure. And they looked at the genomes of the children for an increase in a particular type of inherited genetic chain called a de novo mutation. And these are genetic changes that arise randomly in a person's sperm or eggs and can be transmitted to their offspring, but you don't find them in the parents. So they compared the kids and the parents looking for de novo mutations. And by the way, you will always find a few of these when you do a parent-child comparison because mutation happens. Most of them are trivial and don't affect health. When they looked at this, they found that the number of de novo mutations in children born between 46 weeks after the accident and children born 15 years after the accident, there was no difference. And of course, the children born 15 years later were out of the radiation area. The radiation children had pretty much the same as the general population. So no difference, general population about the same. What this says is that we have really good innate DNA repair, and that's good to know if we do decide to do something about global warming by moving back into nuclear power, which I think we need to keep on the table, folks. Let's just be honest about that. And if we ever do ships, well, we're going to be doing that. Now, they also looked at thyroid cancers in people who were exposed at younger ages to the radiation. And there they found that if you got thyroid cancer from radiation exposure, there was a particular difference in the way your cells, your cancerous cells, DNA were broken. They had evidence of a break that occurred, and then the wrong pieces of DNA joined back together. This is called a gene fusion. People who had thyroid cancer in low radiation eras had different type of mutation, something called a point mutation, which is just a typo in the DNA. The implication here, we've just got 1 minute, but it's rather startling, is for litigation and for finding whether or not a person's cancer was caused by radiation exposure. If this proves to be true for other cancers, it will allow us a forensic tool to blame, essentially, a industrial radiation exposure for a subsequent cancer. And that might have serious legal implications. We'll see how that develops. Come back next week, and I'll have more interesting and provocative science news for you. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, stay safe, and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.